because every opportunity that you make a mistake is one where you can learn and get better. And if you're working with a leader who has a similar philosophy, there's no bad outcome. I mean, obviously certain mistakes are catastrophic and we have to be very careful, but you know, the little ones and the medium ones can really help us grow. And I do think we have to understand the beliefs that we grew up with and then understand whether those beliefs are going to serve us moving forward, or if we want to think differently as we move into our adulthood and our careers.
Absolutely.
Welcome to Elevate Your Career, the podcast dedicated to empowering individuals from all walks of life as they navigate the ever-changing landscape of their chosen fields. In this show, we'll be bringing on a diverse range of professionals from various career stages to uncover the secrets behind achieving success in any industry. We'll explore how they achieved their career goals and the path they took to get there. Your host is none other than Nicole McMackin, CEO of the Irvine Technology Corporation, ITC, an award-winning information technology solutions and staffing provider. Now let's get to the show.
On today's episode of Elevate Your Career, I have the privilege of speaking with renowned author and CIO, Dr. Ronald Glickman. Ron and I will converse about his career trajectory, fear, fight or flight, gratitude, and the process of becoming a leader. We will discuss his new book, Lead for a Change, Proven Strategies to Clarify Expectations, Foster Growth, and Achieve Breakthroughs. Moreover, we will tackle the idea that you cannot make everyone happy, and it's only a well-defined objective that can drive successful outcomes. Tune in for an exceptional podcast for anyone who wants to lead. Dr. Glickman's book can be purchased on Amazon and as an ebook, Audible, or hard copy. And for any questions, Dr. Glickman has provided his email address, and he could be reached at ronald.glickman@gmail.com. Get ready for a wonderful episode. Ron, welcome to the show. So excited to have you, finally.
Hey, Nicole. It's great to be here and to follow such an amazing group of guests. The podcast is great. Congratulations. It's a little intimidating to be on, I have to say.
No, what are you talking about? I've been waiting for you. You're the highlight. I had to get everyone out of the way so I could make room for you. Are you kidding me?
Thank you.
I love it. Yeah. I mean, and we're going to get more into your book, but Lead for a Change. I've read it multiple times, and it is a dynamic read for anyone looking to make transformational change in their leadership skills. And so we'll get to it within the podcast. But first and foremost, since you are an avid listener of the podcast, and you know how this starts, let's do the fun fact about you.
Okay. You want to know a fun fact? I would say in 2004, my family and I were on holiday in Phuket, Thailand, when the tsunami hit. And we missed the wave by about 15 minutes. We had been playing everywhere that got destroyed for a few days before. We happened to collect indigenous art and handmade things, and we decided we were burnt out on the sun and we wanted to go shopping. As soon as we left and got to the first place that we were going to take a look at, the wave hit and caused a lot of damage. And so it was very interesting that we were able to get through that experience and still be here and to talk about the fact that really we weren't victims, but we were witnesses of something that was really tragic. And so it was a lesson to our whole family not to take things for granted.
Yeah, that's so true. I remember when that happened. Now, when you were there, did you know that were there warnings that a tsunami was coming, or was it just a complete shock?
So that's an interesting question. We got a warning from our son, who was about 7 years old, when we had breakfast. While my wife and I were having breakfast, the earthquake happened, and she studied geology in college. So she looked at me and said, "I think that was an earthquake, but they don't happen in this part of the world." So that was weird. Then we went and got the kids getting ready to go shopping, and we were walking up from our ocean bungalow, and my son, who watches a lot of Discovery Channel, looked out and saw that the water had receded a long, long way. And he said, oh, there's going to be a tsunami. And we looked at him, we're like, dude, you watch too much TV. Let's hustle up to the car and get going. That was our early warning. And he turned out to be right because he had learned that the first thing that happens is the water goes way, way out and then comes back in a very fierce way.
Right. Oh, my gosh. And I mean, how, as a parent, I could relate, right? Oh, be quiet. Come on, get in the car. You know what you're talking about. I mean, it's always just because they're younger, right? Yeah. And sometimes the intuitiveness that we just miss and don't realize and don't see. So that was a horrific event. And I am glad and I'm grateful that you and your family are okay and so many others that were able to get out of it.
Thank you. I think the leadership lesson, like many leadership lessons, is that, you know, difficult things happen, really bad experiences. And as I mentioned, in this case, we weren't victims, we were witnesses. And what it comes down to is, how do you make meaning from that experience? What can you learn from it? What would you do differently? And what do you take away that will inform, you know, your perspective and your actions going forward? And, you know, for the whole family, it was, you know, life is precious and don't take anything for granted.
Right. And listen to your 7-year-old sometimes.
Exactly.
Well, thanks for the fun fact. That was a good one and very meaningful. I've known you for a long time. Just to give some background, Ron and I work together in our Women in Leadership course, and we work really, really hard to try to elevate women through storytelling and CIO leadership. And it's been quite profound. And it was really interesting. And you don't know this yet, Ron, but our class had just ended a couple of weeks ago for one of our semesters. And I had everyone kind of organize in a fashion of, it's a 15-week class, and what courses that were led by different CIOs that were most impactful to them. And you lead two of our classes, and two of those classes came in the top 4.
So oh my
I'll
goodness.
Send you the results, but I was really proud, and I was thinking, oh my goodness, of course they came in the top 4. So congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, it's a pleasure. It's so much fun to work in that context and to help people realize that they can lead and give them some techniques for making that happen. And I'm so glad that it landed well. That's great. Yeah. You know, it's been a great journey. I mean, we've been doing this for a long time.
Yeah, almost 6 years.
Yeah.
Can you believe it?
Yeah. And I think you had on that, in that class, a guest speaker who was in our first cohort who now works for me, which I'm super happy about, Marina Cortazzo, right?
That's correct. Yeah. It was actually our second cohort at UCLA. That's correct. Yes. She's a phenomenal, phenomenal woman. And I'm so glad. And she loves working with you. So it's good team there. But let's jump into a little bit about your career and learning lessons. And I know it because we talk about it quite often, your career. And I really love it because I think you're super raw about what transpired and who you are and what mistakes you made and how you transformed yourself. So let's talk a little bit. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Chicago in the Midwest. And I moved from Chicago to the West Coast with my parents just after my senior year in high school. And coolest thing about Midwest people for me is that they're much more relational than transactional. You know, when my friends growing up, if you needed something, people were there for you. We had a sense of belonging. We had a great community. When I moved to California, and no offense to the Californians, it was just more, yeah, you need something. Let me check my calendar and see if I could make that happen because I'm, you know, busy and have a lot of things going on. And it's just a much more transactional sort of place to be. I know you live on the West Coast. And but anyway, I'm very happy that I grew up in the Midwest and I still find myself just resonating and relating to people who come from that part of the country. I think they're awesome.
Yeah. And I wonder if that's more of, well, no, not necessarily. I was going to say more of being in kind of a big city, right? That you don't have as much time, or is it growing up with just different values? And maybe I can speak here, and you know, out in California, everyone's kind of the hustle and the bustle and not near as much, I think, as potentially other areas and other cities across the country. But we always have a million things to do. Work is something that really drives and money. Not that it doesn't in the Midwest either. So I wonder why that is, but I feel that too. Just being in the Midwest, as you know, our daughter goes to Auburn in the South. Very, very different. One country, but very different. It could almost be different countries almost in every state. So yeah, I recognize that. So a little bit of a culture shock probably when you came to high school here.
It was, well, actually, I finished high school in Chicago, came here, had no friends, went to community college because I didn't really have anything to do. And all of a sudden, I got straight A's. You know, I was a terrible student in high school for a lot of different reasons. I had an undiagnosed learning disability, which I'm now aware of, which caused me to struggle in a bunch of different classes. But when I got to California and I focused on my studies, I was able to do really well in school. My parents were having some challenges. I left their house when I was 18 and I needed to take care of business. So I went to work and I was very fortunate to work for The Gap back in the day when they were just getting started. And they had a management training program and I really loved working in the stores and I liked retail. Got an opportunity to go through that program and manage stores at a very young age. I think about 19, I was managing a store and responsible for the revenue and the people and all of that. And I was enjoying it, but I knew that I needed more. And so I decided to go back to school at night. And National University, which is a private university, was just getting started. They were accredited. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to go study business while I work and the combination might be helpful. While I was going to school, IBM came and gave us all an aptitude test for technology because they were going to help the university start an IT program and one of the first in the country. It was very, very early days in the mainframe world. So I took the aptitude test. I passed by 1 point and I became an IT major. You know? There's nothing more than that. It was like, okay, I guess this is what I'll do.
Right. By 1 point, you skim by and look at you now. That's funny.
Well, I'm off just getting by 1 point, but you turn those stories into something very positive. So I, you know, I did my IT major. I really liked it. I found I had an aptitude for analysis and for coding. And when I finished the program, I went back to The Gap and said, I have store operations experience. I now have my degree. You have an IT organization in Northern California. I would really like to join that group because I think I can bring my store operations experience into the IT room. And they didn't even think about it. They were like, nope, that's not happening.
Oh, really? Oh.
We don't hire people who don't understand tech. At that stage, they were only hiring experienced people. So that, you know, was kind of one of my first crossroads. I needed to make a decision. Do I stay or do I go, you know, pursue this unknown career that I think I'm going to really enjoy? And I decided to look for something else to do. And I found electronic data systems. And Ross Perot had an unbelievable brand. He had a very, very structured training program. A lot of ex-military people were in the company. He only wanted to hire people that didn't know anything so he could mold them in his image. And I remember going to this hotel room and meeting a recruiter and getting a super secret offer that I needed to accept in the moment, or my opportunity at EDS would be forever lost. And so I took the offer. I think it was like $14,600 a year. I thought, you know, I died and gone to heaven. And I jumped into their training program. And it was profound. There were three phases. The first was learn a business. So I went and I learned the healthcare business. I worked in a claim shop where people were doing data entry. Then I went back and got my technical training. That was interesting because 50% of the people who got to the second phase of the training program were fired because they couldn't succeed. And I quickly realized it really wasn't about doing the code or getting the work done because they assigned us way more than it was possible for anyone to take on. And they were really looking for how do you build teams? How do you work with other people? How do you work collaboratively to sort of get through difficult circumstances? And so my strategy, which was to date the instructor, that worked well for me. And I got through that.
I was just going to ask you, okay, so did they put you in teams? Was that something that was your assignment and then you broke into it? But you were smart. See, 1 point, you know what you were doing.
Tutoring, obviously. Right. I just get by the skin of my teeth. And so I made sure that I was seeing the tutor quite regularly. And it was an incredible experience. I learned a lot from that. And then I worked in the healthcare industry, supporting Blue Shield of Southern California. And that's where I sort of realized I could be an analyst, because I was working in a print shop and we were printing documents overnight. And these were the days where we had these things called blue sheets. They were big papers and they would print out boxes at a time, and they would be reporting exceptions to medical procedures. So, you know, if it didn't make sense for the medical procedure that you were claiming, then it would go to a human being to look at and decide whether to pay the claim. And every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, I would print three boxes for the same person. Her name was Peggy Merritt, and I've never forgotten her name. And so in the morning before my shift ended, I followed the person who took those three boxes to the individual who was going to deal with the exception, and took off the first page and threw all three boxes away and to be recycled. And I thought, that's interesting. Why'd you do that? He said, well, she gets dialysis, and it's a bug in the system, and it's a repeatable process, and it's not a problem that she gets it three times a week. And so my thought was, well, why don't you fix the software?
Yeah.
Maybe there's a possibility to save me time and paper and all of that. So that was an interesting experience. It sort of got me thinking. I'm intellectually curious, and I really kind of resonate to identifying problems and solving them. And so that was an indication that I might be on the right path.
Yeah, for certain. As I was listening to you, I thought there's a few different ways that companies do things. And Ross Perot's way, you know, molding you and bringing you in at a young age and creating a viable, valuable employee that moves in the direction of his vision and mantra, right? And then you have the gap at that period of time, which said, no, we're only hiring senior level people that are experienced. And we see this a lot with companies all over the world. But I was likening it almost to the healthcare, because I thought when you were going to say with the gap, of course, you had store operations. And what is better than taking someone who faces with the customer from the business perspective and having that individual really understand on the backside how this technology resonates with the end client or their customer? And very similar, you're aware of this, but healthcare, right? They typically take nurses that have been practitioners in the healthcare field, in the hospitals, and they turn them into technology experts because of that same reason, is being able to better service the customer. And Ross Perot loved bringing new people in because of their vision that they weren't situated in just one way, right? And I think that's telling, and I'm only bringing that out because when you are looking for a job, that's really something to note, because when you go and you look at different organizations and you're interviewing, are those organizations going to want someone to do it just their way? Or are they going to be really concerned with teaching you and leveraging your past experience to help their end customers? So it's just interesting. I just was thinking of that when you were talking, because I was shocked. I thought for a moment, I knew your history, but I didn't know that portion that far back. And I thought, oh, they're going to take him and he's going to work at Gap, because that makes a lot of sense in the technology realm. So just interesting.
Yeah. And you're making a really good point. I mean, there's some research by Daniel Pink that talks about what motivates people. And, you know, he says, when money is not an issue, there's three things that we need to think about. Purpose: why are we doing what we're doing and how do we fit into the big picture? Autonomy: how many degrees of freedom do we get to do our thing? And, you know, is it appropriate with our level of experience? And mastery: what are we going to learn in that opportunity? And I always tell people who ask me about looking for a job, not only do you have to sell yourself to the individual who wants to hire you and talk about why you fit, but you should have the courage to find out about these three things. What is the purpose of the organization? How do I fit in? What kind of autonomy can I get so that I can learn in action? And then what am I going to learn that's going to help me contribute? And as importantly, prepare me for whatever might come next. And so, you know, I think you're right about thinking when you're looking at an organization a little bit more broadly.
Yes.
Than just, you know, how do I sell myself?
Right. And, you know, there's so much, we're lucky in this space and time, right? There's so much information out about organizations now that you could easily glean and find? And you know, you're always careful. There's just write-ups about everything and you have to decipher which is true and which is not. But there's just another level of information that we all have that perhaps we didn't even have 10, 15 years ago, especially when we were younger, searching for jobs on our own.
Yeah, and that could be overwhelming. I mean, you could have too much information and you have to be able to synthesize what's helpful and what's not. So I got to that place at EDS, and here's the first big lesson that I learned. So they had an amazing culture. They did a great job training people, but they really wanted you to do it their way. And I had been there about 4 or 5 years, and there was a lot of talk around people are important to us. We want to retain our best people. Tell us what you want to do. And I took that literally, and I got an opportunity. My boss called me into his office. He said, look, you're working in this online group and you're writing, you know, user data entry screens. And I know that that's amazing and you love it, but we want you to go work in a batch group. And, you know, batch processing in that day was what was happening. You did stuff overnight. And, you know, I said, well, that's not really something I'm interested in doing. My girlfriend, who was the trainer that I met, you know, during my education, works in a batch group, and she's up all the time in the middle of the night, and I'm doing all this cool stuff during the day, and I really enjoy what I'm doing. I think I would like to continue to just do what I'm doing. And he said, yeah, I don't think you understand, you know. And I said, well, you always talk about the fact that, you know, you want to retain your people, you want to hear from us, and I'm sharing with you what I want to do. He said, okay, I got it. Called security, packed my stuff in a box, and put me on the street.
No.
Terminated me right on the spot.
Oh my gosh.
I found myself in an interesting sort of position. And as I reflected on that in the moment and over time, everything isn't literal and everything isn't necessarily in the moment. And they really did care about people. And as I look back, I needed that experience and they were trying to help me build my foundation, but it wasn't explained to me in a way that helped persuade me that it was really in my own best interest as well. It was way more a power dynamic and you do what I say or you're out of here. And so that was the first, you know, sort of lesson about the gray in between the black and white and how we perceive what people are telling us and the words and the meaning behind the words that they use. And so it was a profound experience, but one that was a very, very important lesson on my journey.
You know what I love is that is how you took it and you walked away with that and you came to that conclusion on your own, because most people would say, what a jerk, right? It was his way or the highway and that was it, but not really the in-depth understanding, looking at it and saying, look, I'm young. This was an opportunity for me to grow. And I was being stubborn and number one, maybe just didn't understand because it wasn't put in that framework, but that you walked away, because most people, I got to tell you, Ron, would not circle back like that. They would say, I hate that company. They're a bunch of liars. What a jerk. But you actually have the opposite feeling that, wow, he didn't deliver the message appropriately. And I didn't understand it that way, but it was good for me.
Thank you. But that's 40 years of perspective, right? In the moment, I did exactly what you said. I was like, this is bogus, right? I'm out of here. I actually had somebody call me the next day who I had worked with in the company and wanted to hire me back. And I was like, no way, I'm going to go figure out what I wanted to do. So I was on my way. I landed a consulting gig after electronic data systems. I found I really didn't enjoy that. I didn't know enough to really contribute as a consultant. People that we were working for really felt like the billing rate was our salary. I just felt like an outsider. And that was not something that was really, you know, conducive to development or my mental health. And so I kept looking and I found Ralph's Grocery Company, which is where I landed next. And I spent 10 years there and really got my formative development in tech at Ralph's. I was able to take what I learned in electronic data systems. I worked for a great supervisor/mentor and moved from coding to management into a director level over those 10 years. And went back to school and got my master's in business administration at the University of Southern California. And really, that was a very, very formative experience for me. I worked on some leading edge projects, made tons of mistakes, and learned from every one of them. And that's the key theme. You have to look at your mistakes, and the thing, you have to be accountable for those and be a bit vulnerable as a leader. And as you reflect and try to make meaning from them, they're very informative in helping you broaden your base, your leadership base, your competencies, and your ability to contribute going forward.
When you're younger in your career, I found myself, as well as almost everyone, you are so wound up in, I need to work harder. I can't make a mistake. And the dread and the uncomfortableness that you feel when you fail, and you hear people fail fast, it's great. And you just, as an emerging leader or as a person starting in your career, that is the most worrisome thing, that people are going to think that you don't have all the answers. And the reality is that no one has all the answers. And to be able to fail, I've had a million opportunities where I've made wrong choices, but quickly recovered. And it's how you rise above those choices and lean into the adversity that comes perhaps from some of the choices that you've made that makes you stronger. And you never make that same mistake twice. You know, people are afraid of it, but like you, I think it's such an important part of who we are as human beings and leaders.
I think that's right. And I think the key is unlearning potentially some of the things that we grow up with in our family of origin.
Are you ready to break barriers and become the next CIO in the tech world? Here's the exciting news. We've custom designed a groundbreaking course specifically for female executives interested in becoming CIOs. And the best part? It's absolutely free. This women's leadership course is the first of its kind to support female leaders in technology. The program delves into real-life scenarios that CIOs face daily, whether they're leading small enterprises or vast Fortune 500 companies. So if you're a manager, director, or VP of technology, this course is a perfect fit for you. Current CIOs and technology leaders will take you on a 15-week journey, guiding you through a 360-degree view of what it takes to be a CIO, the pragmatics of implementing IT governance, the foundations of C-suite-level project management and portfolios, and so much more. Ready to take a leap of faith in your career? Go to www.irvinetechcorp.com/program, and the link is in the description box. If you want to contribute to a more inclusive and equitable tech world for women, you can start at www.irvinetechcorp.com/program. Join us in our next course for the Women in Leadership program and be part of this exciting journey. Now back to the show.
So, you know, some parents, failure is catastrophic. It embarrasses the family. It embarrasses the child. They want perfection. And so, you know, we grow up. I grew up in a house like that. So I felt a tremendous amount of shame when I made a mistake. And I needed to unlearn that value and that belief. Because as you say, what we figure out and when we can separate our behaviors from sort of our identity, and we can look at those mistakes as opportunities to learn and to grow, both as individuals and as professionals, then it becomes magic. Because every opportunity that you make a mistake is one where you can learn and get better. And if you're working with a leader who has a similar philosophy, there's no bad outcome. I mean, obviously, certain mistakes are catastrophic, and we have to be very careful. But, you know, the little ones and the medium ones can really help us grow. And I do think we have to understand the beliefs that we grew up with, and then understand whether those beliefs are going to serve us moving forward, or if we want to think differently as we move into our adulthood and our careers.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so you're there, you're making hopefully not 100 mistakes, but some in learning. And where did that take you? You're there 10 years?
Yeah, I was there 10 years. It was an incredible experience. I did make lots of mistakes. As a programmer, I was making a change to our supply chain systems, and I didn't do the matching logic particularly well. And so you get SKUs ordered from the stores, and sometimes they have Cheetos in the front of the store on display because it's Super Bowl weekend, and sometimes they have them back on the shelf. And so my program was designed to take all the items that were ordered and sort them in a way so that I added up the Cheetos from everywhere in the store and gave one total to the warehouse so they could pick, pack, and ship the product. And I screwed up the matching logic and I started to mix up SKUs and quantities. And so we sent truckloads of stuff that stores didn't order to the stores. And there was just pandemonium. It was a horrible experience and cost the company a lot of money. And my boss, you know, helped me understand how not to make that mistake again and kept me around. And so, you know, that was an indication that, you know, you can survive some of the dumbest things and you need to pay attention to detail. But the company was very, very well managed and got into this merger and acquisition wave. Ralph's got acquired. It's been acquired four or five times since I've left. And when they got acquired, the new leadership team came in and I decided, you know, maybe it was time for me to go look for something else. I had gone to business school. I had learned that, you know, small companies and equity were really a cool thing to sort of get into. And I got recruited by the private equity company that bought Bristol Farms, which is a small specialty retailer in Los Angeles. And I was their first CIO. It was my first role as a CIO.
How old were you?
How old was I? I was 30.
So young. Young, 30 years old as a CIO. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I was in my 30s, early 30s. I didn't know what I was doing. And, you know, I had to figure all of that out. And it was a very, very interesting journey because I focused on the wrong priorities, not because I was setting the direction, but because the CEO was giving us direction. So we had this little restaurant that was attached to the stores that was a cool strategic thing when produce became less than the quality that we were interested in selling it. We'd move it to the restaurant and we'd cook it and serve it to our customers. He wanted me to focus on putting a new restaurant system in, which we did. But in doing that, we weren't really focused on the retail systems that were required to help support the growth that the company had planned. So we got behind the eight ball on the systems development. And at the same time, there was a bit of arrogance in the ownership at the time. And they started putting stores where people weren't willing to drive to have the experience of this high-end grocery company. And it was a very important lesson for me as I reflected on that. The owner of the company that sold was in his three stores every single day, driving the culture, understanding the people, understanding customers, helping to make sure that everything was aligned. And his thing was, I'm not investing in technology because a penny in technology is a penny that I don't put into my products and my service. And I think the people who bought the company didn't really understand that. And they had a bit of arrogance around, well, we could just open these everywhere and it will all be the same. And it turned out not to be true. And they ran out of money after about a dozen stores. And I was a little bit behind on the IT strategy and decided, you know, this might be a good time for me to exit and go find, you know, my next opportunity.
You know, what I love about what you said, which I would say the majority of people around the world, you said, I'm in my 30s, I'm around 30 years old, and I became a CIO. And you know what? I didn't know it all at that point in time, but I was going to figure it out. And that, I think it's the number one thing that holds people back is their belief that they have to walk into a position and know everything before they get there, and not taking and believing in themselves that once they get there, they can figure it out and that they're smart enough. And I believe and I know that that's the big differentiator between people who make it to your level, the C-suite, versus those who don't, because they don't take those chances at any age to go in and say, you know what, I can do it. I believe in myself. I'm going to learn. Instead, they sit back and say, I can't do that position, because they're afraid, why, of failing fast. They're afraid of fear for how they look. And so that's really something that our listeners should take away from your story, is that here, you're 30 years old, you get in, you didn't know all of it, but you took it anyway, and you gained experience. And look at you now and the trajectory that position put you in, or you put yourself in, right?
I think that's right. And you know, building on that idea, I think it's very important when you get into a new position to quell the anxiety to prove that they hired the right person to do something spectacular or make a change or demonstrate that you're smart. I think the opposite is true. We need to just listen and understand why things are the way they are. Because oftentimes there's multiple ways to do things. Companies are successful over the long period of time. And understanding that and proving to the individuals who have been there a long time that you get it, and then taking their input on where they think the opportunities lie, and then adding your own perspective, really is a much better way to sort of start slow in order to go fast. And you know, even today, if I get into something new or I'm starting something that I'm a beginner at, I really try to just take that deep breath and really understand why things are the way they are, because there are often good reasons. And they're important to understand before you start, you know, changing things around. Right?
Yeah, no, I agree. And so you decide, you see the writing on the wall at Bristol Farms and you say, okay, I'm out of here. Where's my next journey?
And it was global. It was an international opportunity. Back when I was at Ralph's Grocery Company, I got to meet some young IT leaders from privately owned grocery companies, because many of them are family owned from around the world. And I got really intrigued about the global context. And I sent a letter to the head of the International Retail Association and said, hey, I've got this experience at Ralph, big company, and Bristol Farms, little company, and I'm interested in exploring an international opportunity. And I got a call on a Friday night when I was having dinner with my family from a person who was the CEO of a company in Hong Kong. And they had three brands. They had a health and beauty brand, they had a convenience brand, and they had a grocery brand. And they were looking for a CIO to come over and take the helm at the grocery company. And sat down after that phone call and talked to my wife, Suzanne, and said, what do you think? Should we take the kids and go on an adventure? And to her credit, she was like, I'm all in. Let's see what happens. And about 3 months later, we were living in Hong Kong and I was working for a British conglomerate, Jardine Matheson, and I was the CIO of Welcome Grocery Supermarket.
That's amazing.
Chain.
That's amazing.
You talk about not knowing things. I mean, I had.
And you didn't speak the language.
Really something. No, I mean, they taught English in the schools. To be fair, it was still under British rule. But I had 65 Hong Kong Chinese staffers working for me, and I definitely didn't understand the culture or the dynamics. And I sort of went in with my Western mindset. It was interesting because I got everybody together. My first thing was, okay, what are the problems that you see? And let's talk about, you know, if you were me, what do you think we should be working on so that I could understand? And if turns out that was the worst possible question I could have asked. And I got feedback that, you know, you're the CIO from the United States who we brought over. Why are you asking us what to do? What's wrong with you? And it was a very, very bad start.
Well, culturally, that's so different start. Because that's how we are really trained when we go into organizations. The first thing that you do to build, you know, team and cohesiveness is to value others' opinions. And it's a great way to understand what's going on from their perspective on what's wrong with the organization. So, I mean, that's like 101 here in the States, right? So we do that. Oh my goodness. So that was a blowback for you, huh?
It was for sure. But that's the lesson. Everybody doesn't do things the same way. There's lots of ways to do something and achieve great outcomes. And one must understand the cultural dynamics. And in the case of the Asian context, I needed to build relationships one-on-one. I needed to meet people, understand who they were, foster trust so that if I brought people into a group, I could potentially get them to share. But in that group dynamic, no one wanted to stand out positively or negatively. So that was not the way to move things forward. And I didn't understand that. And so it was a very, very, important lesson.
Well, you weren't back on a plane coming back to the U.S., so I'm sure you smoothed it over.
I figured it out. You know, I was there for a 2-year contract and things. I did learn a number of lessons, but that was the most important, understanding the cultural dynamic. My family traveled a tremendous amount. My kids had an amazing experience. And as a result of that, my son went into the Peace Corps, lived in Thailand for 3 years. My daughter's now living with her husband and her son in Rotterdam. So it definitely not only helped me from a career point of view, but set my family on a different trajectory. And I'm very glad that I did that. Finishing that, I got recruited to come back and join Duty Free Shops, a global retailer of fashion and local products. People who travel shop there.
Are you kidding me? Get a break on their taxes. Whenever I travel, are you kidding me? You don't need to explain duty free. Everyone who gets on a plane and travels across anywhere knows that. So that's awesome. That's a big brand.
It was incredible. I was there during 9/11. After 9/11, our sales dropped in half. The leadership team got together and our CEO said, listen, we've got to cut our expenses 50% in order to get this company to a survival state where we can grow again. And we went about executing a strategy that prior to 9/11, nobody would be really interested in because they were big ideas like global sourcing rather than having employees in, you know, 10 different countries and one data center versus 10 data centers and a whole bunch of things that if things were good, people would not have considered because they would have been too risky. But in this case, we got the green light to make a lot of things happen and ended up writing a case study about that journey. It was very, very interesting. And I learned a lot of lessons and built friendships that have lasted for years and years and years as a result of that experience.
I bet. How long were you there?
I was there 6 years.
Okay. And were you in the CIO role those 6 years?
I did not join as the CIO. I was hired by the CIO because this was the dot-com era. So the CIO hired me. And 2 weeks after that, he resigned.
Oh, interesting. He couldn't take you,
said,
huh?
You know, well, I could say that it was me, you know, but, and it may have been,
come
actually.
Come on. Are you kidding me?
But it took me, and my boss at the time, who I have tremendous respect for, he came to me and said, listen, I want to consider you for the CIO role, but there's some things that I'm just not comfortable with. I can't even put my finger on them. I want you to get some executive coaching. And here are three people who you should contact. And I ended up working with a woman named Vicky Farrow, who is still a friend of mine today, all of these years later. And she helped me see some things about the way I was interacting that changed my perspective on how to operate as a senior executive. And so I'm a big fan of executive coaching. It's a private place where you can have a lot of conversations about things that are challenging and troubling and going well without necessarily having it do political damage. And if you can take those lessons in, they can change the trajectory of your career. So anyway, I got to the CIO role and was in position when the time came to be able to drive that transformation. And we did it. We took half of our expenses out. And the thing that drove me to think I needed to change from my duty-free role was about a year after that transformation, bird flu hit in Asia. And sales dropped and the CEO called us in and he said, you know, I need another 5-10 million from each of you. And I absolutely panicked. We had just gone through this 50% reduction. I felt really good about what we had accomplished. My reaction was, how could you even be asking for this when we had done such an amazing job? And I got scared. To be very honest, I panicked. I had no idea how I was going to do it. And I called my coach, I called a recruiter, and I went in and ultimately said, you know, I think I'm going to move on to my next opportunity. A very important lesson.
At that point, when the directive came down to cut 10 more million, did you say, I just don't know where these cuts would come from? I mean, did you say anything or did you just say, oh gosh, I think I got to make my way out of here because there's no possibility of this happening?
It's a great question. I didn't know how to say that. I think I still had my EDS problem where I took what he said literally, and I just wasn't there to say, and now I would respond very differently. It's like, okay, I understand that. Let me work with my team. Let me work with some expertise. Let me come back with options and implications.
Yeah.
Here's what it's going to take to get to that number and what it might mean from a service point of view. Here's another number that might be close, that might be less risky. And have that dialogue with the people who are making the decisions. I had no idea how to do that, Nicole.
Yeah.
And so I just got afraid and I ran.
Yeah. And I think that comes with time and that's so raw and that's so real. And so many people do that when you're faced with something, instead of having the dialogue and conversation, you are faced with, I don't know what I'm doing. I don't know how to do this. I got to go. It's that flight, right?
Fight or flight. Exactly.
And so, and that happens in the business world often. I think that's fantastic. Thank you for sharing that. That's fantastic.
No problem. And listen, feelings come first. The way the brain works, we get our feelings and then we either respond or react to our feelings. And then we can think about problem solving. And if our and feelings are signals, they let us know how we should be thinking about things and what risks and dangers there are. But if we let our feelings, super strong feelings, drive our reactions without taking a beat and responding, you get crazy results like me running away and not being able to process that because you feel like you're going to die.
Right.
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 You feel like your career is over and you're not going to survive, which is very, very rarely the case. And, you know, the best example is Will Smith and the Oscar slap, right? He obviously got a very strong signal and did not take a beat to think through what his options and implications were. And he let his feelings drive his actions. And there are consequences when we do that. And there are consequences, you know, when I left the situation, had I stayed, I'm sure that we would have figured it out and been successful in the fullness of time. But it led me to the next opportunity and the one after that. And so, you know, again, the theme and the thread is reflection and learning your lessons, even if you didn't make a mistake, and trying to put them into perspective so that you could be better in the next thing that you do. And it's a journey and it takes a lifetime. You can't figure these things out overnight.
No, you cannot. No, you cannot. And I think along your career journey, you've learned quite a bit about yourself and how to react and how to move forward. And I did want to take a step back. And as you were talking about coaching and you said mentoring and a little bit, and you yourself are a coach now as well. And I've seen you coach so many people and women who are lined around the corner wanting for you to be their coach. So you bring a lot of value to other people, I think, through your stories and failing fast. And so thank you for that.
It's my pleasure. And I'm happy to contribute where I can, because so many people have helped me on my journey. And it's just very rewarding to give back in that way. And so it's a lot of fun. You've helped coach me and I have helped coach you. And that's the difference between relational and transactional, getting back to where we started, right?
Very much so. And I wanted to take a moment because Dr. Ronald Glickman, you have recently written a wonderful book, Lead for a Change, Proven Strategies to Clarify Expectations, Foster Growth, and Achieve Breakthroughs. And I wanted to take a moment to acknowledge that and really highlight your learnings. And I've read the book a couple of times, and I really love the practicality of it and the action items at the end of each chapter. And the concept that resonated with me most about the book was when you drive business results, you cannot make everybody happy. And I think as human beings, we try so hard to make people happy. If we're not making the business, we're trying to make the CEO happy. We're trying to make our team happy. And, you know, only well-defined objectives can drive successful outcomes. And I think your book really resonated with me. And obviously I have it as now almost a text for all of our women in leadership cohorts. But I think there's so many things that are very profound in that book and tangible and ready to use. And so I wanted to highlight it. And I wanted to understand from your perspective, why did you even write the book?
It's a great question. So, I mean, we've been talking about some of these lessons that I've learned throughout my career, and I've learned them not by myself, but with leaders who I've worked with and who I've worked for and who have become friends. And we've worked together in some cases over multiple change journeys. And there was always, you know, hey, have you thought about writing this down? You know, and it was on a bucket list to do. I never really had the confidence to do it. I've been teaching for the last 10 years at Cal State LA because I finally have a job where I don't have to travel and I get to do kind of coaching in a more formal way. And the leadership class has gotten a tremendous amount of positive feedback, except the scholars at Cal State LA, where I teach, were not particularly fond of an outsider sort of gaining accolades for work without being super scholarly. So that drove me back to school and to become a beginner and to work on my doctorate degree. And I studied the leadership class that I had developed, the curriculum, the teaching styles, and the students to try to figure out in scholarly terms what the big ideas were and whether these things were worthwhile. And the research proved, and not just mine, but confirmed a lot of researchers before me, that leadership can be learned. You don't have to be born a certain way or look a certain way to be a leader. That experience gave me the confidence to publish some articles about some of the things we're talking about. And ultimately, that's when I decided, you know what, maybe I now have the skills and the practice to sort of try to put this book together. So that's what led me to do it. And I'm so glad that you're enjoying it. It's really designed to be a toolkit and something that is approachable and easy to consume. There's a lot of visuals, a lot of models and vocabulary to help people at any stage of their journey to be successful and to realize their potential.
Yeah. And it's a book that I found. Sometimes I'm an avid reader, so I read all different types of books. I read self-help books. I read, you know, fiction, and I love historical fiction, and all. I just consume a lot of different books. And what I love about this one is the practicality of use, is that at the end of every chapter, there's a summary, there's a list of to-dos, and it really, in the moment, helps you think about that chapter, the concept, and then write immediately down what are meaningful items that you've gained and gleaned from the chapter and how you can think about implementing those for yourself. And that's why I've read it a couple of times, because I have a lot of takeaways, and each time there's different takeaways. Because if you're reading it, you know, you gloss over some concepts, but when you go back and you really look at them. So I highly recommend it. And I'm grateful that you wrote it, because I think it's helped so many leaders and potential leaders in their field. So kudos to you. And I definitely wanted to highlight that, because I think it's a big part of your journey and now my journey. So thank
you. That's
so
great. Thank you. Yeah, it's my pleasure. I think that's the key, and why people come back to it. Depending on the situation that you're in, you may want to take a different look at an idea or a concept and how to have a conversation that's going to get you through whatever your challenge is at the moment. And really, in my class, I use the book to teach my class at Cal State LA. I use it in the curriculum in our Women in Leadership program. And I always ask two questions at the end of every session. The first is, what is your big takeaway from your experience? That helps me understand whether I'm getting through, and it helps people understand how to internalize the information. And then secondly, what are you going to do tomorrow to try to apply what you learned to help you be better? And just by asking those two questions after an experience, it forces people to maybe think differently or act differently. And that's where the learning comes in.
Absolutely. I agree.
Yeah.
And so we're going to wind down, but I do have a couple of questions that I wanted to ask you. First is, if someone is wanting to follow your career path or to become you or in your role as chief information officer, and, or it could even be a vice president of technology, what would you recommend? What would be a good path for them to take?
Well, I think that there's multiple paths to get to that end game. And I think a lot of what we were talking about is every experience that you have to take in what you learned and what worked well, what you want to take with you, what didn't work as well that you'd like to change. And you need to practice those changes as you move through your career. And it's also important in every opportunity, as we talked earlier about purpose, autonomy, and mastery. What are you going to gain from your next experience while you're contributing that is going to position you for a bigger and broader opportunity in your next move? Whether or not you take it, it's not as important as getting those tools in your toolkit and being able to say, I have had these experiences and I can apply them in an appropriate way. I would not focus on getting the title. I would focus on contributing and learning, and the title becomes a consequence of a diligent approach to building your career, if that makes sense.
It makes sense. And it's really on your career path is recognizing the experiences in a way that you can take those experiences and move them to another opportunity within a company or without of a company, right? And I always say this, you know, I say, let's stop focusing on our job every second and let's start focusing on our career. So we're all going to focus and do the what we need to for our day to day, but look at those experiences and take those and move those forward in your vision to what your ideal career and your skill set is really going to be and how you should align. So thank you for that. I think that's really good. And then I love this question because it shows a little bit about how you think. But if you were sitting in a park and you could have an edited conversation with one person in the world, who would it be for an hour? You can choose whoever you want. Who would that conversation be with?
It's a profound question. I would have to say my grandfather, because he came to this country, escaped the Tsar in Russia, now Ukraine, came to this country with nothing, didn't have the language skills, and really wanted the American dream for his children. And my mom didn't go to college. I'm the first generation in my family to go to college and have started to realize what he had hoped would happen. And my children are standing on my shoulders and I stand on his shoulders. And I would just love to be able to understand more about his experiences and more importantly, to show him that the investment was worthwhile.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Do you think the American dream is still out there? It's still possible?
Yes. But I think that we're in a very difficult political discourse today where we're not arguing about ideas, we're arguing about identity. And I think we need to find a way to compromise and to figure out how to give some things up in order to get some things that we need and to help others. And until that changes in our political situation, I think it's going to be a little bit thwarted, but I still have hope for the future. And we will see how things end and how it all comes out in the end. You have to compromise.
I agree with you.
You know?
You do. It's a life in just life, right? I do believe in the American dream, and I still think that many can achieve it. And I look at a lot of people like yourself and many others, younger generations and people from different countries that have come here with paradigm shift from their own and they've achieved it. So I agree.
I mean, I would just say this on that topic. I had a guy who fired me, a boss I did not like very much, but he asked me a very, very interesting question. He had come in and taken over for the CEO who hired me. He was going to replace his leadership team. He brought in a CIO to replace me. I knew it was coming. There was some conflict as we were working together, and he called me in his office and he said, "Listen, man, is it more important for you to be right or effective?" And it was super profound for me because obviously we all think we're smart. We have ideas, we have experiences. We think we know what works and what doesn't. And I got it. It was like, go work with this guy and help him to achieve what he's trying to achieve. Set your ego aside. And I really think if our politicians would focus on being effective and not argue so much about who's right and who's wrong, who's good and who's bad, I think the American dream can still be achieved.
I agree. Kudos. I agree. You and I are very, very aligned in that thought. So, okay. I always end the segment with our fast five. So your role model as a child?
My uncle. I told you I left my family of origin's house when I was 18, but my mom's brother was a successful college graduate, raised a family, was working in a business. And I really looked up to him as a model to give me a blueprint for what might be possible. So he was a good man.
As an author yourself, what is your favorite professional book?
I got to say, I love Brené Brown. She wrote a book called Atlas of the Heart, which talks about emotions and how to put things in perspective and be a better human being and as a result, a better leader. And I think that is an amazing book. And I'm calling it professional, whether she calls it professional or not. I think it's a great read and super, super helpful for people who want to improve their emotional intelligence and be great leaders.
Your favorite destination?
I love India. I've done a lot of work there on a global basis. I love the people. I love the food. I love things that are made there. I like the way they help make technology work for many of us outside of that country. I think it's an amazing place to visit.
Your favorite downtime activity?
I like smoking cigars. First of all, I started smoking cigars because my kids wouldn't come near me for 90 minutes, which was a great reason to get started. And I find now it's a 90-minute thing and it's a process. I just sit with my cigar. I try to keep it lit. No one really comes around me. I get to think broadly about what's going on in my world. I can think about gratitude. I can think about where I want to spend my time and energy. And it's not the healthiest habit. It's an amazing way for me to just chill out and reflect.
Your favorite project? It could be something you're doing now or something you've done previously.
You know, I think it's, for me, the projects where I'm helping others and learning on the journey are the most important ones. I ran a charity called Camp Kesem for 10 years. We work with college student volunteers to put summer camps on for kids who have cancer. That was an amazing opportunity. We built the organization from 3 chapters nationwide to more than 50 when I was there. And we raised a lot of money and developed a lot of leaders and helped a lot of families. And that was something that I'm very, very proud of. And I love working with the Women in Leadership Program because I'm committed to helping people who do look like me get ready for the leadership challenges that we face in tech and in society. So there are opportunities where I can take this leadership knowledge and share it and help people realize their potential that make me happiest, even though it's not the goal, being happy.
That's right. But in the end, it's what the it's
a nice outcome.
It is. Dr. Ronald Glickman, thank you. And thank you for all the lives that you've touched, including mine.
Nicole, it's a pleasure. Best of luck. Congrats on the podcast.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed the episode today on the Elevate Your Career podcast. Make sure to hit subscribe on your chosen platform that you are listening to us on. If this episode made you think of someone, go ahead, take a screenshot and share this episode with them, or post it on your social media to share with your friends. You can catch the show notes for this episode and any mentioned links in the description of this episode. Irvine Technology Corporation, ITC, excels at finding top-tier tech professionals and matching them with businesses. Whether you're an employer with tech opportunities or a tech professional searching for the perfect role, ITC is your go-to solution. Visit www.irvinetechcorp.com for more information. Once again, it's www.irvinetechcorp.com. We'll see you on the next episode.